Hi, I'm Jordan McGillis, economics editor of City Journal. Welcome to 10 Blocks. Joining me on the show today is Ryan Bourne. Ryan occupies the Cato Institute's Scharf Chair for the Public Understanding of Economics, and he has a book out this spring that fulfills that very purpose, titled The War on Prices. Ryan, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be with you, Jordan.
Now, Ryan, your job, as your title clearly conveys, is to advance the public's understanding of economics. The premise of your new edited volume is that there's a major misunderstanding about the role of prices and what they represent. Tell us about that misunderstanding and how you seek to correct it.
Well, after this inflation hit, I recognize that there's a lot of the misconceptions and confusions around inflation, which is a change in the general price level, that we thought were buried in the 1970s, were in fact returning to public debate. So, you know, the confusion between relative price changes between goods and services and changes in the overall price level, which inflation manifests itself with, the belief that temporary supply shocks can cause an ongoing or sustained inflation rather than just temporarily lifting the price level, and indeed the idea that workers' wage demands contribute to inflation too. And so as a result of that, I think there's a large section of the population who thinks inflation is a result of malevolent actors or one-off shocks rather than primarily being a story about monetary policy. So I really originally started this book thinking that I wanted to address these misconceptions and talk about the monetary roots of inflation. But the more that we kind of got into it, putting together this multi-author volume, the more I recognized that a lot of the kind of fundamental economic errors, not thinking through the supply and demand model that applied to this inflation, also manifested themselves in debates about a range of price controls and other regulatory interventions in individual product markets too. So the US has seen a big expansion in the use of price controls over the past decade, whether that be the return of rent controls across many states and localities, increased minimum wage rates, anti-price gouging legislation, and increasingly Joe Biden's war on junk fees. So ultimately, I wanted a collection of essays to address three major things: to address the misconceptions about inflation, to look at the real economics of historic and current price controls, and then address some of the moral arguments against market prices that underpin many of these policy ideas.
It seems that a lot of what we're experiencing this decade rhymes with the 1970s. There were a lot of lessons that should have been learned that perhaps weren't. Can you talk to me about what occurred during the 1970s inflation and price controls that were instituted then and how they exacerbated some problems?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as a result of the inflation in the early 1970s, Richard Nixon introduced a raft of different price controls at different times. I mean, ultimately, they manifested in whole economy price controls. But, you know, we go into detail in the book looking at the price controls on oil and gas. And, you know, one of the big takeaways that I took from that chapter was the fact that quite often there are big political economy considerations behind these price controls. So at any given time, for most of that period, there were a raft of kind of exemptions and carve-outs from that legislation. So the major effect wasn't actually a manifestation of price controls resulting in severe shortages, although at certain times that certainly did occur, but actually a big kind of a redistribution, as it were, towards certain players in the industry and towards certain types of consumers. So I think a big theme that comes away from this book, other than the fact that price controls don't really help deal with inflation, they don't really change the economic fundamentals and monetary fundamentals between the balance of the money supply affecting total spending in the economy and the supply potential of the economy, kind of takeaway beyond that is the fact that with price controls, you often get high degrees of redistribution in quite arbitrary ways that policymakers might not intend. So that is a great example, actually, of two key lessons from the book, really, which is that price controls do not help solve an underlying monetary inflation, but also they can create big distortions in the economy that quite arbitrarily redistribute wealth.
Can you talk about some specific examples of the distribution effects of price controls, things that would be familiar to an average consumer?
Sure. Well, it depends what price control we're talking about. So, you know, if we're talking about, well, one price control that people might be more aware of because it affects many people are minimum wage rates, which is, of course, a price control on wages. So a price control on the returns to people's labor. And, you know, one might think about that and think, well, that's surely good for low paid workers, right? So we're mandating through government that pay levels per hour, at least, are going to be higher for that group of workers. But of course, that's not the end of the story. If you set a a minimum wage rate too high relative to the kind of market level within the economy, too high relative to the return to people's productiveness in any given role, then you risk reducing demand for their service. So one potential redistributive effect of that is the fact that some people on the margins of the labor market, those often with the lowest skills, the least experience, may find it harder to get jobs as a result. But that's not the only way a firm might adjust. We have a great chapter in the book by the academic economist Jeffrey Clemens, who outlines the fact that there are many other ways that businesses may adjust to increase minimum wages. And that includes tinkering with much of the remuneration package that a worker might receive. The firm might offer less in the way of generous healthcare benefits, for example. They might decide to give the workers less flexibility over their schedules as a way of managing those fixed costs. So the distributional effects, even of a price control on labor, can be very interesting, because on the one hand, you might think that just mandating a higher wage rate for low-paid workers will improve their lot. And for those that retain their hours, their jobs, and nothing else about their package changes, that may well be the case. But then you also have to look at the broader impacts, which can include fewer jobs for certain types of workers, fewer hours being offered by employers, or just cutbacks in ways that make the jobs perhaps slightly less pleasant or reduce other benefits that people could get within their remuneration package.
I see. And another quite familiar form that you mentioned earlier is rent control, which is kind of the opposite. It's putting a ceiling on the raising of the price. Can you describe how that affects people?
Yeah, so rent controls are probably the most studied form of price control out there. And as you say, as a price ceiling, they kind of work in the opposite way. I mean, the crude kind of old style rent controls, of course, just capped the absolute dollar amount that a landlord could charge for services. And the problem that you get there is that in a world in which, say, demand for rental services is increasing, and so the rent is held below the market rate, you can induce a shortage in the sector. Now, for a vast variety of reasons, including the fact that usually when rent controls are instituted in the real world, there are lots of exemptions and carve-outs. Quite often, even though some people can find it more difficult to get properties, there are other ways that landlords might adjust. So one way is that landlords may just allow the quality of their property to deteriorate so that the new capped price kind of reflects the market value of the rental services that they're offering. As part of that decision to not put their property on the market, so reducing the supply, they might convert that property into a condo, for example. We've seen lots of examples of this when rent controls have been instituted across the United States, or they might look to sell it for owner occupation. So there's a range of ways that individual landlords adjust depending on their circumstances. And the fact that you get a lower overall supply when you introduce these things that reduce landlords' flexibility or reduce the rents that are able to charge, means that paradoxically, rent control, which is often instituted in the name of helping poor renters, can actually mean there's fewer properties available for them on the market, or when they are available, they're actually of a kind of lower quality. So that's kind of the first order effects of rent control. Of course, there are broader economic impacts too, such as rent control's beneficiaries, those who do get rent control properties, face a strong incentive then not to move to another area which doesn't have rent control properties, because they might lose that benefit. So, you know, all sorts of weird and wonderful effects from what looks like a policy on the surface designed to help the poor.
Both of those styles of policies, minimum wage laws and rent control, are pretty strongly left-wing coded, at least here in the United States. But there's another form of public discontent that doesn't seem to have any left-right valence. Everyone's irritated by them, except for those of us weirdos who really love capitalism, and that's airline fees. People hate seeing these small little dinks and doinks when they look at the receipt. They want to be able to put their bag underneath the plane as they use without an extra charge. They want to be able to choose a seat. But airlines have found that they can create the most efficient process that satisfies consumer demand and makes them a profit by charging for these little parts of the experience. Talk to me about how consumers should view that and how airlines respond to the discontent and how the government is responding.
Yeah, certainly. So since the deregulation of airlines have largely unbundled many services. So in effect, what that means is rather than paying some all-in price that guarantees that you'll get a particular seat, you'll be able to take two pieces of luggage, you'll be able to board, you know, in a line in which nobody gets preferential treatment. Instead of doing that, airlines have built out pricing structures in which you can kind of pay for additional services that are of high value to you. Now, individuals might not like the fact that those are kind of separated out, because what we tend to think as we're going through the process of buying a ticket is that we tend to regard these as additional charges rather than the airlines adjusting the fees so that certain people pay more than others and you have a degree of cross subsidy. But in effect, what airlines have done through doing this is democratized air travel. And what do I mean by that? Well, one of the consequences of being able to charge people for whom it's really important to board the plane first, or to carry extra luggage, or to have a specific seat on the plane, one of the consequences of that is airlines have been able to lower the basic ticket price, which has enabled air travel to be relatively affordable to vast numbers of people. Now, obviously, if you were to regard all of those fees as junk fees, as the President Joe Biden often seems to imply, then one natural consequence, if you were eventually to go the full hog and kind of ban those fees, would be that airlines would bundle up all of those services and just charge one overall price. Now, that would mean, in effect, that people were paying for services that they didn't really need. And because of the overall base price being higher than it is today, a lot of people, particularly those on low incomes, would find it much more expensive to travel and so be much less likely to do so. So we may not always like the fact that we see these fees added as we go through the process of buying a ticket, but we have to think about how that compares to a world in which those fees and charges were kind of banned or didn't exist.
How does this public discourse relate to credit card regulations that are being discussed, or legislation perhaps being discussed on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, so President Joe Biden, since his State of the Union address last year, has really tried to clamp down on what he defines as junk fees. Now, it's not always clear what that definition is, but certainly part of that is to look at fees and charges within the financial sector. So one of the moves that the administration has made in recent months is to reduce the kind of cap on credit card late fees. And they've tried to sell this as a massive kind of boon to consumers. You know, if you pay your credit card slightly late, you're kind of getting ripped off by credit card companies. But of course, that's not the end of the story. You know, credit card late fees help internalize the risk for the business of taking on relatively risky customers who are unlikely to pay their bills on time. And so the agencies and government themselves admit that introducing such a rule where you reduce the kind of cap on credit card late fees may in fact lead to other adjustments by the business, whether that's increasing the interest rates that these issuers charge, increasing minimum payment amounts, or adjustments to credit limits to reduce the risks of taking on customers who tend to make late payments. So that will obviously offset the total price of using credit cards for many customers. So, you know, for the vast majority of customers, but they won't see big net savings as a result of this reduction in credit card late fees. And in fact, it may well mean that risky customers might lose access to credit services entirely, and then in effect, they face an infinite price rise. So, you know, again, we have to be very careful about thinking about the trade-offs for what ostensibly looks like, you know, reducing one fee can actually have a kind of bit of a waterbed effect and lead to other adjustments in the pricing bundle that are to other consumers' detriment.
There's a strong similarity between that dynamic and minimum wage laws, where the ostensible beneficiaries will actually often lose out entirely on either employment or the service being offered.
Yeah, that's certainly right. And, you know, we see this across a whole range of sectors as well. The similar thing with rent control. Those who are unable to find properties, for example, find themselves in a similar position. And that's what we're trying to get across with the whole book. We're trying to give a broad conception of all the kind of margins of adjustment we tend to see when price caps or wage floors are set. And that can quite often be a much richer set of responses than just changes in quantity. It can mean changes in quality of the goods as well. So we have a broad number of chapters that look at these issues in a fair degree of depth.
Turning to a deeper portion of the book, chapters 21 and 22 deal with gender discrimination. This chapter by Vanessa Brown Calder, titled "The Gender Pay Gap Isn't About Workplace Discrimination." And then you have a chapter that's titled "The Pink Tax Is a Myth." Can you give us an overview of these two chapters?
Yeah, so certainly. So one of the big themes that we kind of hear that pushes back on the morality of market prices is the idea that, you know, firms within markets charge women more through virtue of them being women and pay them less through virtue of being women. So I look at the pink tax in a fair degree of detail. This was the idea that we heard in the 2010s that market prices were inherently sexist. It was all kicked off by former New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's Department of Consumer Affairs, and then a range of people jumped on the bandwagon. And what they did was they compared a bunch of different gendered products which they thought were sufficiently similar and looked at the prices for those marketed to women against men. And lo and behold, they found that those marketed to women tended to be, if you look at a range of studies, about 7 to 15% more expensive. So you might look at that and think, wow, you know, companies are exploiting women. They're charging them more. They're making more profits off them. Now, as an economist, that makes little sense. You know, if these goods were fundamentally the same, but just differently branded, and women themselves were kind of genuinely indifferent between them, then they have an easy option, which is just to buy the men's versions. So an economist would look at this and think there must be meaningful but perhaps subtle differences between the products. And that's exactly what the researchers tended to find. Some economists who were commissioned by the Federal Trade Commission looked at personal care items in detail, which is the market that tends to be brought up most here. And they found that, yes, you know, if you do a crude comparison, you see this big pay premium on what women are paying. But if you actually control for the main ingredient, so you're comparing genuinely like with like product, women's versions tend to be only very modestly more expensive on average and cheaper across a range of different items. So the conclusion that comes away from the literature is actually women tend to prefer products in many sectors that have higher marginal costs of production and distribution. You know, this is not women being ripped off by companies, it's women choosing products that they willingly pay more for. Indeed, women tend to be less brand loyal than men. They tend to be more astute shoppers. So this is actually a kind of free choice that people are making. And you see a similar story, really, when in regards discussions of the gender pay gap. People tend to look at the average, you know, pay rate between men and women and assume that this is businesses discriminating against women. And I have no doubt that there is some degree of discrimination against women within certain employers. But when you really look at the carefully calibrated studies, what they tend to find is that the overwhelming degree of the pay gap is driven by differences in occupational choice, if you're looking at an aggregate level. But then even within occupations, the fact that as women get to an age where they become mothers, they tend to be less likely to maintain jobs that are kind of client-facing, require them to be on call the whole time, and they tend to work fewer hours per week. And once you control for all of those factors, the remaining gender pay gap tends to be much, much smaller. So, you know, you can argue the degree to which that reflects a broader societal discrimination, but what it certainly doesn't appear to reflect is individual businesses discriminating against women.
Do you know much about changes over the last, say, three decades in gender disparity in pay?
Yeah, well, you've seen a big decline in the gender pay gap over that period, the aggregate gender pay gap in that period. And that's perhaps not surprising because the educational opportunities available to women, the number of women going into higher education has expanded massively over that period. And indeed, if you look at certain cities like DC and I believe New York, women under the age of 30 tend to be paid more on average than men right now. So as women have obtained more opportunities to participate in the labor market and been taking those opportunities, the idea that there's inherent kind of sexism because of somebody's sex just doesn't appear to be there. That, I think, is very good evidence of the fact that what this is really about is choices that occur within families as families get to the age in which they begin to have kids.
And that's very good news for Sephora. What are some of your other favorite chapters in this book that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, there's a wide range of chapters, but I would just highlight one of the chapters in the kind of inflation section, which is David Bettworth looking at the extent to which this inflation really was driven by supply shocks and the Ukraine war. So the degree to which it was really, you know, things going on as we came out of the pandemic or the Ukraine war. And, you know, he certainly acknowledges that at particular times, there were clearly things that were going wrong on the supply side of the economy, which temporarily raised the price level. But you can only really explain the ongoing sustained nature of the inflation by acknowledging that at the same time as that was occurring, there was far too much macroeconomic stimulus in the economy relative to our capacity to produce goods and services. So a simple way of looking at this, which he explores in great detail, is to say, okay, well, let's presume that we didn't want policymakers to adjust to all these supply difficulties by also squeezing demand at the same time. That might have caused a recession. Instead, let's say that an ideal thing for the government to have done through, mainly through the Federal Reserve, would have been to have a constant growth of nominal GDP, which is total spending on goods and services in the economy. So try and keep the demand side of the economy growing stably over that period. And what it shows that is actually, you know, beginning in late 2021 through 2022, we saw excess stimulus, which ultimately manifested in that total spending on goods and services way exceeding its pre-crisis trend. And that, I think, is the smoking gun that shows the vast majority of the overall problem that we've seen in this period was on the demand side. That is, we saw way too much stimulus in the form of not just borrowing by Congress and signed off by the president, but also excessively loose monetary policy, which has manifested in much higher prices across the board for consumers.
Ryan Bourne's new book is The War on Prices. Ryan, where can our listeners find that book if they want to make a purchase?
You can order the book already for pre-order Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and a range of other bookstores. And if you want more information on the book, including, you know, a preview into some of the advanced praise for it, you can look up my Substack, which is called also The War on Prices.
Okay. Substack is The War on Prices. And where can they see your work on social media?
The best place is probably to follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Mr. R. Bourne. Unfortunately, Ryan Bourne was not available when I joined Twitter. There is a Ryan Bourne on there, but he hasn't tweeted since 2009.
Well, perhaps with the proceeds from this book, you can buy him out. We'll see.
If I can find him.
All right. No, as always, you can follow City Journal at City Journal. And on Instagram, you can follow us at cityjournal_MI. Ryan Bourne, thank you so much for joining us today on 10 Blocks.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us for the weekly 10 Blocks podcast featuring urban policy and cultural commentary with City Journal editors, contributors, and special guests.